organizing effort was in fact aimed at stopping the genocidal U.S. involvement in the destruction of the poorest country in the Arab world, Yemen.
And finally, Ed Hedeman, David died as his and his beloved cat, who he injected with insulin twice a day.
Yes.
Also died as David was taken to the hospital.
Yeah, after David was taken to the hospital.
His cat, Shaman.
Shaman died, yes. It was tragic all around, but at least David never knew that Shaman had died.
They were very close.
Oh, absolutely.
On that note, we're going to wrap up this part of the discussion, but Jeremy, I'm going to ask you to stay on, and we're going to do part two and hear David McReynolds talking about pacifism and why he was a socialist. Yes, David McReynolds ran for president twice on the Socialist USA Party ticket, longtime pacifist with the War Resisters League. Ed Hedeman, his colleague at the WRL, and investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill both knew him for decades. That does it for our show. Check our part two conversation at democracynow.org under web exclusives. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Tune in on Thursday, August 31st at 8 p.m. to celebrate the queer programmers and the queer community of KBOO as part of our 50th anniversary. Emma Lugo of Transpositive will host this special on-air program. You can join us that night at the Queer Community Open House here at KBOO at 20 Southeast Avenue from 7 to 10 p.m. on August 31st. More information about the Queer Community Open House and anniversary programming is available at kboo.fm.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of EFFECT on Thursday and Friday, September 6th and 7th at the University of Oregon White Stag Block in Portland. EFFECT is a two-day conference that examines the work, culture, and design of social change. This grassroots event featuring stories from multiple marginalized activists, creators, and technologists working towards social change. Again, that's AFECT on Thursday and Friday, September 6th and 7th at the University of Oregon White Stag Block, 70 Northwest Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Oregon Symphony, located at 909 Southwest Washington Street in downtown Portland. Presenting Gary Trudeau, political cartoonist and creator of Doonesbury Comics, sharing from his latest book, Sad, Doonesbury in the Time of Trump, Tuesday, October 16th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets and more information available by phone at 503-228-1353 or online at orsymphony.org.
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio and More Talk Radio. I'm your host, Linda Olson Osterlund. Those who are regular listeners know that I'm not Cecil and Celeste, your usual hosts. They're going to be taking a few weeks off and be back, I believe, in about 3 weeks. And I'm happy to be able to guest host for them today. My name is Linda Olson Osterlund, as I said, and I have a guest for you today. It's really interesting. We're going to be talking with a woman about a sociologist who studied young affluent white Americans and how they see race. So let me introduce you to her right now. Her name is Margaret A. Hagerman. She's a sociologist and assistant professor of sociology at Mississippi State University, and she's the author of the new book, White Kids, Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America. Welcome to KBOO, Margaret.
Thank you, Linda.
And is it okay for me to call you Maggie?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay, great. I saw it with the kids that you interviewed called you Maggie, and so I thought perhaps that's what you like to be called.
So let's talk about why you chose as a subject of sociology, even a subject of sociology to talk about, to look into the area of race and race relations. Why did you choose, if you can tell our audience, why did you choose to look at privileged white children in particular?
So when I was in graduate school, I did a lot of reading and research, and I was really fascinated by the really important scholarship that's been conducted with parents who are raising children of color. And what that research really gets at is this process of racial socialization and how it is that parents are preparing their kids to live in a world that we know is structured by race and that is filled with racism and, you know, potential opportunities of discrimination and prejudice. And so I thought that research was really powerful, but I was curious about sort of the flip side, like how are white children learning about race and racism? How are they learning in the context of their families and in these private spaces of the white home? How are they learning ideas about race that, you know, either contribute to race, to the perpetuation of racism, or maybe they sort of challenge it? So that was sort of the what drove me to start doing this project.
And when you decided to do it, you you picked up a city in the Midwest. Talk about the city and the communities that you chose to pick and why you picked them.
Sure. So I chose the particular city, and I don't actually name the city just because I want to try to keep some anonymity for the families. But the city is a medium-sized city. It's in the Midwest, like you said, and there's a big public university there. There's a big hub for politics and a big medical world. You know, so there's a lot of people that have affluence and upper middle class status, which is something I was looking at. This community also has some interesting political divisions within it, and so I thought that might be kind of interesting. And then also, this is a place that a lot of people say is, you know, the best place to live, although I feel like there are a lot of places that people say that about. But, you know, I wanted to kind of go to this place and see what was happening here.
And the method of study, you call this ethnographic studies. Can you explain that, how it is that this is actually a sociological study, not just someone going and spending time with families and children?
Absolutely. So ethnography is a research methodology that is used by sociologists, anthropologists, et cetera, has a long history. And basically, this is a method where you basically try to embed yourself into the a community that you're trying to study, or in my case, these particular families and neighborhoods. And I think it's really important when studying white racial attitudes, because what we know is that when you give white people surveys and ask them what they think about race and racism, they often do things like they don't answer the question, or they give the survey response of, I don't know. And so what that means is it's difficult to actually, you know, figure out what it is that white people are thinking. Because, you know, I think a lot of times they don't want to be offensive, or they're concerned about how they'll be judged and so forth. And so ethnographic research and qualitative research, where we do interviews and observe people in their everyday lives, you know, there are scientific methods that come with this, and it allows us to get a different sense of a community, and in my case, how people are making sense of race and other sensitive topics that they might not be honest about if I gave them a survey.
Yeah. I wanted to tell our audience that they will have a chance to call in with their questions and comments, just as always with Cecil and Celeste, but I will take this first 20 minutes so that we can get into the, you know, the full body of the book. So I really saw that this was a very interesting topic, and when you say affluent, why don't we talk about what that affluency means? Because it's significant that these are not just middle class or upper middle class families, and how that section of our society has a particularly strong role in defining race and policies, et cetera.
Absolutely. So the way that I measured affluence or class, and, you know, there's lots of different ways to do this, but the way that I decided to do, and I drew upon other scholars, their methods, was to look at three things. So the first thing was whether or not the families owned a single-family home. We know that home ownership is one of the biggest elements of people's wealth portfolios, and so I wanted to make sure that I was accessing families that not only had maybe high incomes, but also had wealth. So that was the first criteria. The second was that they had high levels of education. So I think almost almost everyone in the study, and at least one parent in each family, though, again, many times both parents, they had advanced degrees. You know, they had JDs, PhDs, MDs, and so forth. And then the third thing was that they worked in professional occupations, and we in sociology have sort of these, you know, different ways to identify, you know, where these different professions fall. So if you fit those three categories and you had a child that was in middle school and you identified as white, then you could be included in the sample. And to get to your second point, yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the intersection of racial privilege and class privilege, because like you said, we know that, you know, people that tend to have these sorts of privilege tend to, you know, in childhood, they tend to become powerful and influential people in adulthood. And so that's one reason that I thought it'd be interesting to understand how, you know, the future powerful people, you know, how are they thinking about something like racism and inequality in childhood. I also, though, I want to add, I also think that white children, particularly affluent white children, also have a lot of power, like, as children. What we know from research on, for example, residential segregation is that a lot of times white parents who have the means to choose where they live are buying homes in neighborhoods that are connected to public schools. And so, you know, it's their kids that are actually driving a lot of these decisions about where to live and where to, you know, spend their time that contribute to larger forms of structural inequality. So I think that white kids, you know, even when white children protest things, their voices get heard, I think, in a way that maybe isn't true for kids of color. And so I think there are a lot of different reasons to study people in positions of privilege and power.
Yeah, I noticed that recently the kids in Parkland, after that shooting, one of the things they learned really quickly that the gun issue was different, say, in Chicago than it was when your school is in a middle-class suburban area and shot, and that the gun issue has to do with other things. And I would say it was good to see from the outside that at least a lot of these kids were reaching over immediately to include that and to even push it forward and to say this is an important issue of why we should stop guns, not just why we face it in our homes. So I thought that was an example of kids learning from each other and pushing forward in these kinds of issues. I wanted you to talk about the age of the kids you selected was relatively young, and that was because that's the time when young people are forming their ideas on these issues more, or about who they are in these issues. Is that correct?
Correct. So one of the things I try to be careful about in my research is to draw upon lots of different disciplines. So I really draw heavily on child development literature. And what we learn from psychologists who study child development is that, you know, this middle childhood, and I've sort of picked off a chunk of it, this is when kids are starting to think in more broad terms, like they're beyond just themselves. They're spending a lot more time outside of their home and outside of the context of their family. So they're, you know, they have more friendships. They're getting more involved with extracurricular activities and so forth. And so, yeah, this is a really important developmental time also for thinking in broader ideological terms. So they're able to start thinking about broader systems like racism or sexism or things like that. And so I thought this was an important time period developmentally to do this work. In addition, there's a lot of research on high school age students, and there's some really important research done on really young children. In fact, there's even research, there's a book called The First R that's really great that looks at kids in preschool and sort of how they're learning about race. And so, but this middle childhood, there's not a lot of scholarship on that, and so that's another reason why I wanted to sort of fill this gap.
And you went in there and you got to be inside these families basically operating in several different ways, though all of them knew you were doing this study, but you did babysitting and driving kids to events and that kind of thing. So you got to have that kind of, I used to be a counselor with teenagers and we called it car counseling, the time in the car when you're picking up a child who's run away or you're taking them to an appointment when they're in care. Those are the times when you really get to know the child. So you sort of were able to insert your life, yourself, into their lives and hear them when they weren't necessarily expecting to be heard and other times when they planned to be heard from you. So let's go ahead and get into the three groups of families and kids that you did choose. And you pointed out right in the beginning that the choices the parents made, like you just said about where to buy a home, that those choices and then the ones that follow from that have a lot to do with developing racial attitudes.
Absolutely. So, you know, one of my main arguments is that children are learning about race, and particularly these white children are learning about race through the social environment that their parents construct for them. And again, because these parents have a lot of economic resources in addition to their racial privilege, they have lots of different choices available to them. And so I'm curious as to why they make the particular choices that they do. And so, as you mentioned, I find that there's three in this sort of small-sized city, there are three different neighborhoods that white affluent parents are really opting into. One of them is actually in a nearby suburb. But there are at least three different kind of contexts that I call them racial contexts of childhood. And so these neighborhoods are much different from one another, even though they're all places where these kids live, and they're connected to different schools, and they are connected to different, in closer or more distal proximity to other groups of people, like there's a black neighborhood, there's a Latinx neighborhood, and so forth. And so, the choices that these parents make about where to live sort of sets the foundation for where their children are then spending their time, and then therefore developing ideas about race.
Yeah, and so you found that like one of the communities, the suburban community, was almost completely racially segregated, and was these are very, very wealthy families who, you know, have homes elsewhere, can go on expensive trips and vacation, have a multitude of extracurricular activities, and yet they still managed to make almost all of those activities be around exclusively white people, though they did not think of themselves as racist. In fact, they thought of themselves as colorblind. And can you talk about that theory of looking at race, this colorblindness, and how it was the colorblind that appeared to be the most color conscious, actually, when you go through the book and pay attention to it.
Yeah, so, right, so these parents told me that, in fact, when I approached them to do the project, they were like, why do you want to talk to my kid? My kid doesn't have anything to say about race. They genuinely believe that their children don't see race or they don't notice race. Which is very interesting to me, because if you talk to their kids for only a few minutes, you find out that they actually do think about race and they do notice race, and of course they do, because they're growing up in America where, you know, race is a really it's one of the organizing principles of our society, right? They notice patterns when they look at the composition of the U.S. Senate compared to the composition of a professional basketball team, right? They notice these racial patterns, and they have questions, and they have anxieties about, you know, saying the wrong thing and so forth. So they're obviously aware that race is an important feature of American society, and that racism, is out there somewhere. They have different ideas about that. But yeah, these parents, they thought that if they just kept their kids in predominantly white spaces and didn't talk about race, that was going to lead them to have kids who weren't racist. And I will say it's really important to note that no one in my study told me that they wanted to raise a child who was a bigot or who was, you know, explicitly racist or anything like that. All of these parents really believed that they were doing, you know, the best that they could for their kids. And I just think there's some really big differences in terms of how white parents are thinking about, you know, what kind of messages about race do they want to instill in their kids.
And it's interesting to me that they very much they very much see themselves as sort of, you know, having the correct approach to this, and they actually see, even it was to the point with where their children were not really even supposed to talk about race at all, that they felt that if you spoke about race, you were racist.
Absolutely. And I was really struck, even one of the schools in this particular community, they had a rule, at least according to the kids, they told me about this rule that they had, that they weren't even allowed to use the word racist at school. And I think that when I try to figure out the logic behind this from the teacher's perspective, I think it's because these children, I noticed, used the word racist as an insult, like, oh, you're racist, about things that had like seemingly nothing to do with race. Maybe things like, you know, what team do you want to be on? Do you want to be on the team with the white pennies or the black pennies? You know, the little sports, you know, games or whatever. And they would kind of use this language. And I think the teachers maybe thought that if they just, you know, made it so that no one could use that word, then they wouldn't, you know, have to sort of have these conversations with the kids about why that was a problematic thing to say. But the consequence of it was that when I asked this little girl, like, well, what happens if somebody does say something racist at your school? Her response was, well, no one at my school is racist. That would not be a problem. And so it's really just shut down the entire, like, even the possibility of having real conversations about racism in this community, at least at this school. And I was really struck by that, particularly because then, you know, 10 minutes later, this same little girl is telling me about going to a sleepover party, and the girl's, you know, saying really mean things about the like, two black students at the school, right? So she's, like, talking about race on one hand, and then on the other hand, telling me that no one even notices race. So it's very complicated.
Right. And I noticed that some of the kids would bring up something about race, like a teacher who picked on one of the children, or some event they saw that was racist, and how the parents in that community, the Sheridan community, would say, no, that wasn't racist, and would really work to kind of dissuade that, to really try to maintain that there, it's a post-racial society. They also seem to say that another part of that whole belief was, if you work hard and you're a good person and you work hard, you will achieve your goals. So that's how we're in a post-racial society. I do want to open the phones in a few minutes. I want to let the audience know once again, this is Linda Olson-Osterlund on More Talk Radio. If you tuned in a little late and you were expecting Cecil and Celeste, I am sorry for that, because I know how much you appreciate that show. I do as well. But I'm the guest host, and I have a great show for you. We've been talking with Margaret A. Hagerman about her book, White Kids Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America. And this is a book that came out of 2 years of embedded study in affluent communities in the Midwest. So we'll open those phone lines in just about another 5 minutes. Can you tell me really quickly what the other two communities were and how they were different from each other and from the Sheridan community?
Sure. So one of the other two communities that I refer to as Wheaton Hills, these are parents who told me they really value diversity and multiculturalism, and they are more inclined to talk openly about race with their children. They identify as sort of politically moderate, and they thought it was important that their kids understand, you know, have some exposure to diversity. However, these are the same parents who, a lot of them sent their kids to private school, because even though they said that they really cared about diversity, they had lots of reasons why the public schools that were actually diverse were not suitable for their children. And a lot of times their discussions about diversity and multiculturalism were very shallow, and they, they weren't really getting at structural inequality. They were getting at just, like, different, you know, celebrating different foods and languages and things like that. And so that was sort of their approach. And then finally, the third group is a neighborhood that I refer to as Evergreen, and they really identified as anti-racist parents, and they really kind of brought that to their parenting approach. A lot of them were very much involved in activist work, racial justice work. They identified as politically progressive, and so on. They almost exclusively sent their children to public schools that were racially diverse. But even still, in those families, I identified some really powerful ways that those parents are reproducing inequality, even at the same time that they're trying to fight against it. And so that's sort of one of the big conundrums that I look at in the book.
Yeah, and I think for anyone in our audience, if you're not an affluent parent, neither am I, but you went through these issues anyway. You had to decide where you were going to go to school. Maybe you had no choice because your economics put you in certain neighborhoods, but I know that still people try to make the best choices they can for what that school will be. And, you know, there's a whole concept in this book about the good parent, and that a good parent, it seems like in most of their minds, a good parent goes ahead and tries to be as affluent as they can be. They move themselves into that class status if they didn't just grow up into it. And that's not something they reject, and yet they do, some of them very much consciously take on issues of racial oppression in this country and work really hard at it, and yet still can't see where within their own approach there is, it's problematic. And I think that was really important for all of us to see, because our audience here at KBOO is generally a progressive audience, we would say, and Portland likes to think of itself as a progressive town, and yet on every single measure, it is a town embedded with racism, whether it's trying to get a place to live, getting a job, the school you go to, the way the police treat you, the way the justice system treats you. And yet there's still a desire on our parts to think of ourselves as progressive. And if we want to seriously be progressive, it's important to really dig into how we're not, how we don't mean to be, but we're giving the wrong messages if we really want to get rid of racism in the United States. I found that pretty interesting because you had a good cross section. And I want to talk one more about, you know, the thing about children's agency around this kind of issue, it's not that children are just empty vessels taking in everything their parents say, is it?
No, and that's actually one of the really powerful lessons I think that my research can teach us, is that kids are not simply mimicking their parents' positions. Obviously, parents influence their kids' ideas. But, like I said earlier, you know, I think that parents' influence is more about the environment that they set up for their kid, right? Like which schools they go to, what kind of friendships they encourage or maybe even discourage. I saw some of that. And so I think that then kids are in those environments and are sort of making sense of the world as they experience it. I saw a number of cases where children would challenge their parents. So their parents would say something and the kids would be like, "Mom, that's a really, like, that's a bad thing to say. That's racist. You know, here's why, blah, blah, blah." Likewise, I had examples where children would challenge their parents' anti-racist perspectives and say, "Yeah, I understand you're saying that, Mom, but I noticed this pattern at school and, you know, blah, blah, blah." So I think that you can see that there's some contestation going on between these children and their parents. And I think that's important because, you know, that gives us maybe some opportunity to think about the role that children will play in challenging the racial status quo in the future.
Okay. Well, you know, we have two callers on the line. I'd like to go ahead and go to the first one. Margaret, I'm going to let you answer them directly, or if they want it to be to me. And so let's go ahead and get the first caller. It's Cody. Hi, Cody. Margaret. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Osterlin. Hi, Margaret. How are you guys doing this morning?
Good.
Outstanding subject, by the way. Thank you so much. And Arcelin, you're doing a great job of taking my hat off to you. Gold star.
Thanks.
People are basing their experiences based on what they're taught by society. And, I mean, as an African-American, I started deeply into it, and I started to realize that there are a lot of decent people out there that are basing their realities off of pure and unadulterated ignorance and just not knowing, okay? And a good example is in how our public and college education is how it's teaching this, like, 1.0 version of history. Mm-hmm. And Black history specifically concerning slavery and MLK, right?
Yeah.
But you're coming out with so many amazing discoveries about how African Americans were denied their FHA loans after World War II, and how those FHA loans were directly connected to the segregation that created that chasm between African American descendants of slaves, not Native Africans, but people who could trace their lineage back before the Civil War, and white Americans. And my issue is that why aren't people like Richard Rothstein, for instance, wrote The Color of Law. He also wrote The Way We Were, or All Else Equal Are in Public, or Teachers' Performance and Pay. I mean, this guy, he kind of like focused about around the subject that you guys are talking about. And how is the control of media stifling that understanding how is media stifling this knowledge from being disseminated out to the regular public? Because this Richard Rothstein guy, he's just blowing my mind about what was being kept insofar as the redlining and the secrecy around it, you know, and how this kept going right up until the 80s and the 90s. So I'll let you guys, like, comment about this, and mainly, you know, it's about people basing their experience off of older, very, very flawed version of history, and how it forms their vision of a person when they see them, not realizing that this person probably still carrying a lot of lead weights on their backs, and they're completely oblivious to that fact.
Well, I think that's a good question, Cody, and I know that, Maggie, you did study how media impacted these kids' lives as well, didn't you?
I did, and thank you for all those great points, Cody. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I'm a college professor, and I see firsthand sort of the, you know, kids, that, you know, students that are coming in from after high school and what they've learned and what they haven't learned. I mean, I'm living in Mississippi, and I have students that don't know anything about Reconstruction, you know, so I totally hear what you're saying. I think that something like, you know, the fact that, like you said, 98% of home loans as a result of the New Deal went to white families between 1934 and 1962, like, that's a big deal when we think about the intergenerational transfer of wealth, which is what many of the families in my book are experiencing. But to get to the point about social media or media in general, I looked somewhat at social media, but the kids in my study were a little bit too young. They weren't really into that quite yet. But I did find that the media was a major source of information for them, for better or worse, kind of like you mentioned. And so things like having the news on in the background, like some of the parents didn't think that their children were paying any attention to the news. And yet, of course, you know, they were. And they talked about it, and they had things to say, and they wanted to know about it. They wanted to go to school and be prepared to have a discussion in the classroom with their teacher. And then also television programs. So there's a lot of research about sort of the representations of race in things like kids' TV. And so there were a couple of television shows that the parents that were living in the sort of colorblind context, they used as like a way to teach their kids about diversity, which I thought was really interesting. So there's a show like Glee was one of the shows they mentioned. And this was like their strategy for exposing their kids to diversity was through this television program. And incidentally, that television program, you know, often tries to erase structural racial inequality, right? They're not actually interrogating that deeply. So another, just to give one other quick example, one of the moms told me with great pride how she used the film The Help to teach her children about, you know, domestic work and race and racism. And I mean, that film has been like highly critiqued by historians for being, you know, extremely problematic and in the way that they represent history. So again,
and so despite
points,
the title, but also puts the white character is at the center of it, and it's right, her exactly. observations that count. Yeah, you know, I think that's a really important issue, the issue of the media and how it influences us and how parents try to control that but do, you know, just can't do that good a job of it so that kids are hearing. I can remember as a small child hearing, and I should never have had to hear, Paul Harvey, a horrible, I think both racist and elitist, a man who used to, right-winger, who used to have a radio program on that went out throughout the nation. And I can remember listening to that when I must have been, you know, certainly under seven. And even just from that, I got the idea that he was mean. You know, I could walk away with that. We do have another caller on the line who, it's James. Welcome to KABU, James.
Oh, good morning.
Hi, I can't quite hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Okay. Oh, nope, now I lost you again.
Hello?
Hi, there you are.
All right. Okay. You know, this is a really interesting topic, only because of the fact that, you know, and at least from what I can understand with a lot of the white folks that I spend a lot of time with, they, you know, before I've really gotten a chance to really educate them and really help them to understand, you know, my plights as a Mexican American, you know, it's like a lot of them really believe that racism just boils down to actions. You know, they think that, you know, it's you know, and what I explain to them is that, you know, what they think of as racism is actually prejudice, where you're talking about singular actions that seemingly happen in a vacuum. But when you discuss racism, you have to discuss the entire system. And I think that that's where they really have the hardest time, because, you know, a lot of them pride themselves in being law-abiding citizens, but they don't understand that many of the laws that we have were put in place specifically to allow white folks to move almost unencumbered through the world while, you know, people of color continue to struggle. And so it's like when people tell me, well, you're a law-abiding citizen, well, it's like, well, what does a law-abiding citizen mean if the laws discriminate?
Yes.
You know, so it's like really opening up that you know, because it seems like a lot of it is that, you know, because they, you know, they don't really, they don't, what they think of is like oppression or discrimination when they can't, you know, when they, when people say like, oh, you know, you, that's so white or whatever, you know, it's really just like, that's their first time of experiencing or very few times experiencing something like that. And it's a very sensitive issue. So, so it's like, instead of being able to talk about it, it's like, it's just, well, we just need to shove it way down. We need to not talk about it. And I think that, I don't know. I think that this is such an important thing to talk about. And, you know, and really getting that type of insight from where you're not, like she said, you know, you're not taking a survey. You're actually getting into their lives and really experiencing things firsthand. Whereas if they were just to, you know, do a survey, it would just be kind of one and done. So
yes, one of the things that I most enjoyed about this book is throughout the book you identify the individual children that you work with and what their idea, you know, their age, what school they're in, and what their ideas are about these different things and how media affects them or how their parents' choice of this housing or how they push back on their children, on their parents. And so we got to really have a more, I don't know, it's a more whole experience of what these children's lives are like. Did you have any particular question that you wanted to ask her, James, or?
I guess one of my questions is like, how much pushback did you really, I mean, I don't know how, I apologize, I came to this a little late, so I don't know how deeply did you probe the adults in the situation as opposed to the kids, and what type of pushback did you receive from the parents when it felt like things got a little too heated for them? Like, what was that experience like?
Yeah, so that's a really great question, and I really was feeling moved by all the things you were saying. The structure, you know, the importance of structural level, you know, racism, et cetera. But yeah, in terms of the pushback, so one of the things that is true about my project is that I'm white, and I grew up in a community very similar to this community. I did not grow up in this community. And so I really was able to strategically use my own position and how I'm positioned in the racial hierarchy to gain access and to build trust. And so I was able to walk into country clubs, and no one questioned who I was. You know, I picked up kids from school. I was in the parking lot at the end of the day. You know, nobody thought of me. You know, I was an innocent white woman, you know. And so I was able to use that position to build rapport and to build trust. And I think that was really important because I, like many of these parents, told me that they wouldn't have told me the things they told me if I wasn't white, if I wasn't a woman, if I wasn't young. They all assumed I wanted to have kids, you know, and that they're kind of giving me important lessons. And so I really do respect all of the participants in my study. And, you know, but I also want to bring that critical lens to what's going on in families and what's going on beneath the surface and behind closed doors and in these spaces that, you know, are really private. So, I mean, there were moments where things got a little heated, but I, of course, wasn't the same person as a researcher as I am when I live my everyday life, right? I'm not going to get, I'm more interested in what my participants think, not what I think. You know, it's not about me. It's about understanding the sort of thought processes and then the actions that go along with them of my participants.
Yeah, I think that's very important and part of your in the form of your approach with it, and so that people could feel that you weren't there to judge them. Even then, sometimes people got very uncomfortable just talking about any of these issues at all. And so I think that it was very important that they were able to feel as comfortable as they were and that you did offer them respect. You didn't think of them as bad people if they didn't have a certain set of ideas. And I think that made the work possible to do. I do think that you noticed that they didn't have very much history, it seems, about Black America and about racist history. Mostly, in fact, they often conflated whole sections of history, you know, like hundreds of years sort of like smashed into one in terms of their knowledge. And so certainly ignorance of the true history plays a large role in this. We do have another caller on the line. I'll let him come on the line. His name is Mike. Mike, thanks for calling. This is Linda.
Yes. You know, I have some questions. First of all, when you talk about fluent kids learning from their parents, most of the older generation now were once hippies. And back in the day when they were hippies, they were anti-establishment. I'm assuming a lot of them was anti-racist and all. But as time progressed and they got in positions, then they start perpetuating the same racism that they, as children, were against. So now that the rich kids you're talking about, their parents was once hippies. Also, another question is, when you talk about racism, are the white kids only racist against black people, or all people of color? So you don't differentiate between that, because there are people of color that are racist themselves. You know, I've encountered Asians that are racist, Hispanics that are racist, and
well, I think this study was specifically looking at white affluent communities because of the overall role that they can play in our society as a whole. And so it was looking at the messages about race that young affluent children are getting, both from their families but also from the communities they live in and the media they take in and their extracurricular activities. So the focus was specifically to find out from them
who are they racist against? Who are they racist against? Are they just racist against African Americans? Are they racist against other people of color?
Maggie, do you let Maggie get into that?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And actually, they had all kinds of different racist stereotypes that they drew upon with respect to basically any, you know, all different racial groups. There were Islamophobic things that were said to me. There were all kinds of things about immigration that were said to me that I personally, you know, would identify as racist. There were comments about African Americans. There were comments about Asian Americans. It was really across the board. So certainly in this community, there was a lot of tension between, I think, sort of the Latinx and black community and the white community. So that was sort of the focus. But again, I heard, you know, these kids had all kinds of ideas. There were some things that happened, like current events-wise, during this time period that really shaped them. Like, for example, Osama bin Laden was killed, and the kids had a lot to say about that. There were some other really high-profile things that happened, including the horrible tragedy of Trayvon Martin being killed, murdered. And so, you know, that was something that was also happening when these kids were kids. You know, they're kids. They were in middle school, and so certainly I heard them say all kinds of things. But you know, I was actually really interested in what you mentioned about the hippies. And I think, again, it's important to recognize that within even this one small community, there was a big range in the parenting approaches, and there also their own politics, their own way that they identify in many different respects. But I think that you're making a really excellent point about people who are really identify as really progressive and anti-racist, and they want to, you know, fight the system, but they're also raising children in that system, and they still have all of the advantages of whiteness and also wealth in this case that come with their position, regardless of whether they reject that, you know, at least in words. And so I think that part of the issue, what's going on here, is that we have this collectively agreed upon idea in our society that being a good parent means giving your kid the best opportunities. And so what that means is, for people who are trying on the one hand to, you know, fight racism, but on the other hand are trying to give their kids all these opportunities, it doesn't really work out, right? That's a sort of a conundrum, or it's a paradox. So for example, you know, parents that are opting into the public diverse schools because they want to support the schools and support the idea of integrated education and so forth, but then they're like getting their kids private tutoring on the side, or they're like signing their kids up for some extracurricular activities, you know. And so ultimately they're still conferring these unfair advantages to their children, but they're doing so in a way that allows them to sort of save face, and they're like, well, look, I participate in the public education, you know. So that's only one example. Certainly the book goes into many more, but I think that's actually a really important paradox to consider. And what does it mean, like, for our future? Like, what do affluent white parents maybe need to reconsider when it comes to decisions they make about their own kids?
Really important areas that you dove into. I want to take a moment right now to let our audience know what's coming up on KBOO today. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 is the Old Mole Variety Hour. It talks about the importance of good reading habits for children, climate change politics in Oregon, and the implementation of the peace accords between the FARC and the Colombian government. At 10 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein interviews ecologist Charlie Chris Fuley while hiking the Hummocks Trail on Mount St. Helens. Excuse me. And at 11 on the ground radio, hears counter-protesters' voices at the Unite the Right rally at the White House. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support, like you out there in the audience. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. If you'd like to call in, the number is 503-231-8187 if you'd want to talk in and weigh in on this important conversation. Maggie, can you talk a little bit more about the differences in, I'll change that. I want to go right to the group of parents that considered themselves more progressive, that recognized their own privilege. Excuse me, I'm sorry. All of a sudden got a little cough going on here, but who recognized their own privilege as white people with affluency and education and the positions that gave them in a race-stratified society, but who wanted to fight against that, who saw that as that, I think some of them said, with great privilege comes great responsibility. We have to push back. It's our responsibility to actively oppose racism in society. And so, but even in those parents, as you just mentioned, they kept creating opportunities for their kids that took their kids out of that situation. But I noticed also there was the thing about saving people. Mm-hmm. And you talked about that in the book, about the savior complex. Can you discuss that a little bit?
Absolutely. So one of the chapters in my book focuses on both volunteer work as well as travel. And these were two things that many of these families participated in. And in both of these, I noticed this pattern of the families feeling like, on the one hand, it's important to expose my child to diversity. You know, I want my kids to understand that they are living in a position of privilege and that if I take them to this country somewhere in a different part of the world, they'll notice some things about themselves, and that's good. So that was on the one hand. On the other hand, they then would approach that with this idea of either we're going to save these people that we're helping and that ultimately objectifying the people that they're encountering, while simultaneously thinking of themselves, putting themselves at the center, right? That I'm going to do this work of you know, I don't know, building a school or whatever. At the local level, this manifests itself in terms of things like soup kitchens and homeless shelters, participating in those actions in part to feel good about themselves, like I'm a good white person because I went and like helped these poor black people eat dinner or whatever, right? Like, and that was kind of the logic that many of them were drawing upon. And so I think that maybe their intentions were okay, but like the way that it actually played out and most importantly, how it played out for their children and the lessons that the children took away from those experiences, I think were that there were some pitfalls along with some opportunities. So for example, the children sort of thinking of themselves as, well, in the future, I'm going to take charge. I'm going to save other people. I'm going to be the one that comes up with the solutions. And I think that in general, and actually some of my colleagues have done research on anti-racist organizations, and we see some of these similar patterns of white folks, you know, having good intentions, but then ultimately making it about them and sort of centering themselves and centering their ideas about what needs to change rather than taking a back seat and, sort of being a co-conspirator with their, peers of color and asking, you know, what can I do to support this larger racial justice agenda or whatever. And so I saw that sort of taking place with some of these children as they were observing their parents in these types of volunteer and travel experiences.
One of the things that I noticed was even somewhat in among those families, there was this notion that part of the reason that African-American kids may not experience as much success is because their parents aren't there for them. And so even some of these parents who wanted to be anti-racist would still have that, but I was there, I showed up, in contrast to a black parent who maybe wasn't there. And there was that theme through that went all the way to the Sheraton, to the most segregated of them, that black parents don't show up for their kids. That seemed to be a theme that the parents had. And then a sort of racist theme that the kids would have, the ones that came out was that black kids are all disruptive or a problem in school. And that's why I don't like them, though they wouldn't say don't like them. And so even through the different groupings, those themes seem to carry on. And that's part of that why I have to rescue you. Your parents don't show up for you. I have to help rescue you as methods of working against race. And in fact, they don't work against race. They reinforce that there's something wrong with the black family.
Absolutely. And when they do that, they're drawing upon well-established racist narratives about black parenting, and specifically black mothers, and actually also black fathers. I'm thinking of one example in the book in particular. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are not ideas that they have just randomly come up with. There's a long history, going back to things like the Moynihan Report, right? There's a long history of understanding these racist understandings about black parenthood. And I think that's absolutely true, that even in these families that think of themselves as part of an anti-racist project, when they tell their children that the reason that the reason that this kid is at this homeless shelter is because his parents didn't care enough about him, or if the reason that the kid isn't doing well in school is because his parents didn't advocate enough for him, I mean, that's just reproducing racism, like, flat out,
And that's one of the main things that you wanted to find out, is how do families reproduce racism, and looking at different, how do affluent families in particular, because of their potential position in society as we go forward. I think it was really important to hear in reading this book what the kids had to say and how those themes kept coming through. And almost a little cringeworthy if you've done your own activities where you think, was I trying to act like a savior there? Boy, that kind of sucks, doesn't it? You're having to look at yourself and your own activities with a little more critical lens going forward. I do believe we have another caller on the line, though, and his name is John. So let's bring John on.
Hi, great show. Really enjoying it. I'm 71 years old, and I'm an old hippie, Vietnam vet, all that good stuff, mostly white. Grandmother, my mother, a lot more Native American than I have genes. They put up with a lot of racism, and so I know what it is in my own family. I was lucky; I grew up middle class. And my points are, I think, for all of us, is until the USA, all of us, come to grips with the evil of slavery, what it was in this country, only 130 years ago or so, and then 100 years of Jim Crow, and understand those things, which wrecked the African-American family. And I always like to tell people, hey, how would you like to have your sister, brother, father, uncle, grandfather, etc., daughters, sold off on a block, slavery block, and till we come to grips with that, and then follow the money. Who runs our society? And the epitome of it is Trump and who is the ultimate divide and conquer representative of institutionalized racism in the USA, meaning that until we get more integrated, which I'm happy to see at my age that it's happening more and more, that and look at our history and study our history. I encourage everybody get as much history as you can, including myself. That we will continue to have these problems, and it's back to truth and reality. And please, everybody, especially young people out there, vote November this year, 2018. Register now if you're not registered, because the only way we're going to change this stuff is voting, peacefully. I don't want to do it violently, peacefully. We have to do it because not enough of us vote, and that's how this Trump scum got in power. And their main thing is the epitome of divide and conquer. Study who the ruling class of this country, who has the money, and how they manipulate us. And thank you very much for taking my message.
Well, thank you, John. Thank you for calling in. Maggie, did you have anything you'd like to say?
Well, there was a lot there. I appreciate the comments. And, you know, one thing I've been thinking a lot about, people have been asking me what I think, is that, you know, my book mainly takes place in a pre-Trump presidency. So this was, you know, these kids, like, the only thing they ever knew was Barack Obama as president, right? That's all they ever knew. Some of them did not even recognize the significance of the election of the first black president, because that was so, it was almost like normalized for them, because that was all that, you know, as far back as they could remember. And so I've been getting some questions about, like, you know, do you think that sort of this widespread belief that America's post-racial has changed since the election of Trump, and specifically his explicitly racial rhetoric? And so I've been thinking a lot about that, and I do think that when I conducted this research, like we mentioned earlier, some of these parents genuinely believed that racism was not that big of a problem anymore. And they, you know, they told me if racism still exists, it was certainly not a problem in their community, right? Maybe a problem, you know, down in the South or something like that. But I imagine that some of these very same parents might be in a kind of shocked right now, sort of in this moment of Trump. And I think that we have evidence from political science and other fields that many white liberals across the country were sort of shocked with the election of Trump. And I think that that was probably true for some of the parents in my study. But I think that this shock that's been experienced by these sort of affluent liberal white people, and also their recognition that there are other members of their own community, affluent, highly educated, you know, white people who voted for Trump, I think that has led to some maybe degree of recognition by white people that racism is indeed a social problem, you know. And of course, this is something that members of racially marginalized groups have been expressing for centuries. So I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, I think potentially maybe one positive byproduct of this explicitly racist rhetoric and policies is that there are more deliberate conversations happening about racism, and maybe this colorblind ignorance can kind of fall off since it doesn't really get us anywhere. But again, and going back to, I think I forget who it was, but somebody earlier who called in, you know, I think there's still a lot of struggle to understand racism as a structural problem rather than solely one that operates in the minds of individual people. And I think we have to get beyond this idea that being racist is just saying something nasty, and instead it's about policies, it's about laws, it's about history and so forth. So I don't know if that really, you know, offers any interesting insights, but I have been thinking about that a lot, and I have been getting a lot of questions about it.
Well, and I know that, Maggie, when you went back to look at the kids that you had interviewed in 2015, and by then they were in high school, and one of the things that you noticed was that they were more that they grew stronger in their own beliefs, they were more sure of what they believed, but also that they were more polarized in what they believe in. And I suspect that we would find even greater polarization now than we would then, because I'm not sure that the Sheridan parents, you know, I'm not sure that they aren't supporting Trump, even with all of this overt racism. And I'm not sure how they live and justify that. But, you know, it's their party mostly. They were mostly, I assume, Republicans because of their conservative beliefs, and they were proud of their conservative beliefs. And so I would expect that the polarization has even gone more, while the kids who are aware of racism to some degree but didn't think they had anything to do with it or had to do anything about it, to the kids who thought they did have to do anything about it, I bet they've all moved a little further even in those beliefs. But I'm not sure about the kids who grew up in the community of you know, that was more segregated and more fluently and specifically white in who the kids all ran up with. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's an excellent point. It is true. I went back and re-interviewed a selection of the kids a couple years, they were in high school, it was a few years after the initial first two-year project. And one of the things we talked a lot about was police violence, and particularly, you know, the murder, killing of black youth.
Which we have in abundance here in Portland as well.
Right. And so, so I talked to them a lot about their opinions about this. And there had been a black teenager who had been killed in their community very recently after I went back, or right before I went back. And, you know, it was interesting. There were very different opinions. And I think your sort of speculation is sort of mapping onto what I found. But the kids in Sheridan, you know, they were kind of thinking of the, they kind of thought of themselves as belonging to, like, the All Lives Matter camp, you know, like, this isn't about racist policing, this is about, you know, people doing bad things, that kind of thing. Whereas the children that were, that, well, they were teenagers at this point, from Evergreen, they were much more critical. They were participating in walkouts at their school, led by their peers of color. They were a lot more engaged, I think, in this sort of conversation from the perspective of this is an injustice. And so, anyway, I do think that that sort of the ideas that were percolating in middle childhood sort of became cemented as they got older. And I would be curious. I'm thinking about going, if I can find the time to go back and try to re-interview them, maybe now that they're in college. So yeah, I think it's interesting. I'm also, I just want to mention, I'm doing another research project right now where I'm interviewing children in Mississippi and also in Massachusetts about, like, the current moment and, like, being a kid that's grown up with Obama as president and now Trump is president, and what does that mean about their ideas about democracy and racism and inequality and so forth. And I'm in the process of analyzing those results, but I can tell you they're fascinating and very polarized.
Yeah, I'm very, I look forward to seeing that book and getting a chance to read that. So don't take 6 years to get it out.
Yeah, I know. I got to get on it.
We want you to go faster. You know, we had another caller on the line, but we really don't have time to take him. I'm sorry, George, that we weren't able to get to you. And for the audience, I want to remind you that I've been speaking with Margaret A. Hagerman. She's the author of White Kids, Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America. And even though this is a sociological study, I think because of the ethnographic approach, because you were inside the people's lives, you know, hearing them both when they meant to be heard by you, but hearing them when they didn't mean to, and catching all the nuances in between, and doing it all very respectfully for all of the families that you interviewed, I found the book very readable and really interesting, and it certainly made me think about the way that I raised my kids. I think if you could say one thing in conclusion, I would like you to say is something about that the choices parents make really have a huge impact on how this goes.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the simplest way to put it is that actions speak louder than words. You know, I mean, you can say all kinds of things about how you're anti-racist and you, you know, want to fight oppression, but at the end of the day, it's what you do that really matters. And I think that that really can be seen clearly in this book and in this research.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Margaret Hagerman. And this has been Linda Olson-Osterlin with More Talk Radio. Next will be online will be the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thank you all for listening.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Radioland. I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio. I want you to listen to and support KBOO because Portland needs it, you need it, and the world needs it. Ubalagani, boing, boing.
Happy National Radio Day.
From your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Help us celebrate by taking a selfie
and posting it on social media.
Hashtag National Radio Day.
Here's to all the great radio in Portland and all over the world.
Happy National Radio Day to you.
Happy National Radio Day
Happy
to
National
you.
Happy National Radio Day.
Happy National Radio Day to you. You.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the August Amzi After Dark, featuring Insexuality, ultrasonic love songs, and death dances from the Panamanian rainforest on Wednesday, August